Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Moscow and speak with a leading defense analyst, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is on the staff of Novaya Gazeta, one of the few newspapers and media outlets not controlled by the Kremlin. He joins us to discuss the growing military confrontation between Ukraine and Russia over alleged Ukrainian incursions into Crimea that appear to be pretext for a massive military buildup that could be aimed at Putin's broader objective to bring Ukraine to heel while taking Odessa and opening up a corridor to Transnistria in Moldova. With Putin considering Obama a weak lame duck president who was on vacation, while his likely successor, Hillary Clinton, is much more hawkish, Felgenhauer argues that the time is ripe and there is a 50-50 chance that Putin will launch an overwhelming, bold attack to bring Ukraine back into the fraternal Russian embrace, which apparently Putin feels is the wish of the Ukrainian people, who have been manipulated by mendacious Americans and poisoned by fascist nationalists. Then we will speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author David K. Johnston about his latest book, a New York Times bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump, an expert who has uncovered so many tax dodges that he has been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. We'll discuss whether efforts by Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine to shame Trump into releasing his tax returns will work, and whether GOP efforts to make Trump more presidential will ever succeed, since he regularly goes off script and grabs the headlines with inflammatory remarks and fabricated claims. Then finally, at a rally in Pennsylvania on Friday, Donald Trump used clear racial overtones in front of a mostly white audience, claiming that the only way he will lose in the key swing state of Pennsylvania is, quote, in certain areas, quote, other people don't come in and vote five times. Dr. Terry Madonna, the director of the Franklin and Marshall College Poll, who is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss Trump's call to his followers in Pennsylvania to, quote, help me stop crooked Hillary from rigging this election. And joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And from 1994 to 2005, he published a regular column on defense in the English language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. His regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Well, thank you.
And what do you make of these rumors of war in Crimea? The provocations of these alleged incursions almost border on the comical, but there is a fairly substantial buildup of military forces on the de facto border between Crimea and Ukraine. So could this break out into a real war?
It could. The possibility of further escalation, military escalation, is very much there. And it didn't begin with these alleged Ukrainian incursions into Crimea. It's already for some time during this summer that tension was building up. I can name quite a number of very nasty kind of items, each of them, of course, not catastrophic, but all leading to in the same direction. About just over a month ago, a top American diplomat told me in private that in the phone call to President Barack Obama, Putin said that Ukrainians are preparing a major offensive in Donbas, and this can lead to war. That same diplomat told me that, according to American intel reports, it's Russia preparing a major offensive. Then later in July, there was this open letter, posted by the Russian UN ambassador, Mr. Vitaly Churkin. You can find it on their website. A letter which was addressed to the chairman of the Security Council, about the same lengthy letter explaining that Ukrainians are attacking civilian populations, killing people, and are preparing a big war. Well, if maybe what Putin told to Obama can be interpreted as a way of scaring Washington, for Washington to put pressure on Kiev and Kiev to make concessions to Russia, this letter by Churkin just seems to be exclusively a legal disclaimer that when war comes, Moscow will say, we told you that it's coming, you didn't do anything, you didn't put pressure on Kiev, and now you're responsible for what's happening. Then, of course, there was the sudden recall, unprepared, of the Russian ambassador, Mr. Zurabov, from Kiev. So right now, diplomatic relations are just kind of on very reduced. There's only 5 Ukrainian diplomats left in Moscow, more or less the same number of Russians in Kiev. No ambassadors here or there. And actually, Russian Prime Minister and other officials now have saying that maybe Russia will sever diplomatic relations at all. And in the modern world, that means more or less war.
And Dr. Felgenhauer, do you think that there's a factor involved in this, and that is that this victory, in quotes, by Vladimir Putin in annexing Crimea, which was largely bloodless, was a big media event in Russia, but Crimea has proven to be extremely expensive, and this bridge across the Kerch Straits that Putin's friend and judo partner, Arkady Rotenberg's in charge of, I understand that the construction is not going well. It's an extremely expensive undertaking. Is there an economic motive in trying to, through military means, form a land bridge from the Donbass into Crimea, because the whole project is just proving to be too expensive?
No, I don't really think that that's a major factor. The factors involved are basically strategic intent. And it's Russian strategic intent in the entire Ukrainian issue is obvious and has been stated time and again. Russia demands absolute guarantees that Ukraine will continue to be for eternity an unaligned nation, maybe eventually becoming part of Russia, but more importantly, not under any circumstance integrating into any European North Atlantic institutions. And to achieve that goal, Russia is ready to do what it takes. Apparently, right now, and after this rather bizarre incident of reported Ukrainian diversions and guys getting ready to kind of make some terrorist attacks in Crimea, Putin commenting said that he does not recognize the present government in Kiev, believes that they are non-legitimate. So this is about regime change. It's not about a bridge to Crimea. There are no serious problems with Crimea logistics. You don't need that bridge. Well, it could come in handy, but to use the existing post-Soviet infrastructure, you'd have to take not a bridge, you'd have to take half of Ukraine, because the bridge doesn't follow the shoreline of the Sea of Azov. And maybe Russia is thinking about a different bridge, a bridge to Odessa, to take Odessa and build a bridge from Crimea to Odessa to link up with the Transnistria and establish the Transnistria as an important military base to have a good spot to attack the American missile defense base in Romania. Because that will make military sense, much more than the Crimean bridge. So we're talking about possible regime change, massive military action that would totally destabilize Ukraine and bring the collapse of the present government and maybe a breakup of Ukraine as a nation. Of course, the timing is very important. Because if there's going to be any military action, it should happen in the coming several weeks, or not happen. Because of weather conditions and everything, in the fall you don't fight in those places. I mean, you can fight, but massive and effective offensive warfare is more or less impossible because you can't pass the fields with your troops and trucks. They turned into a sea of dirt. It's called Rasputitsa in Russian. So mobile offensive action is prohibited till, I don't know, January. And right now it's a unique situation politically. The West is totally in tatters. The United States have an election, a lame duck president, an election that has polarized America. Europe is also right now, because of Brexit, because of the crisis of refugees, is also totally disunited. So Russia may believe, Moscow may believe, that if we go right now, we will not meet any serious Western response, just rhetoric. The West right now can't gather its act, hardly gathers its act to keep existing sanctions, slapping joint punitive additional sanctions if Russia moves in Ukraine will be not easy. And, of course, any kind of other action on top of sanctions seems totally impossible. But this can change. By next winter, or especially next summer, there's going to be another president in the United States, and Washington may resume to be an effective leader. So a summer Olympic Games, August, is the time you go, like with Georgia in 2008. And this is a unique opportunity. If we miss it right now, most likely some people are thinking in Moscow, then we'll kind of lose this opportunity forever, maybe.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And since 2006, he has been a defense analyst on the staff of Novaya Gazeta, and he joins us from Moscow. So do the Russians have the military assets to forge a corridor past Odessa down to Transnistria, which is in Moldova, right on the Romanian border?
No, I believe so. Because the thing is that, unlike 14, the Ukrainian military are much better organized, hardly better armed, but better organized. So if Russia goes in this time, it won't be some kind of hybrid undercover pretending that these are some kind of separatist volunteers or something. If it goes in, and again, it's not clear that it will happen, it's maybe 50-50, it happens or it just simply doesn't, it would be with full strength. I mean, Colin Powell stuff, I mean, throw in everything you have. Russian tank armies, Russian air force, full strength, hitting all the territory of Ukraine, Russian ballistic missiles and cruise missiles hitting specified targets deep inside Ukraine, airfields and so on. So this would be a major war to swiftly rout and break up the Ukrainian front line and send the Ukrainian military scattered and running. That would be the objective if we go in. So this will, that means it's important that this is not, as Russia right now is pretending, that in Donbas it's an internal Ukrainian crisis, internal Ukrainian civil war, that Russia is not involved. Right now we have this situation in Crimea, and this is already legally two sovereign nations sliding towards war. Because if we go, we have to go with everything we have. So I think we could. Russia could mobilize 150,000 men and quite a number of heavy equipment to throw at Ukraine. Well, how will Ukraine resist? Will their resistance be effective, or it will swiftly crumble? Well, that's an open question. That's maybe only decided in the course of action.
Well, we have to go back, though, I assume, to when Ukraine had the referendum on whether they wanted to integrate more with Western Europe. And that's when Yanukovych opposed the referendum and then half-heartedly joined it. And then there was the uprising and Yanukovych was kicked out. So the assumption surely is, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, that a lot of Ukrainians don't want to be part of Russia. So even if there's a military victory, what happens? Wouldn't there be a massive guerrilla war? How would you occupy Ukraine?
Well, I don't believe that this is a sound policy. But many in Moscow, and absolutely President Vladimir Putin, I mean, it's quotable, he said so many times, he said that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, one nation, basically. That now there are some differences, but they have been caused by foul Western American influence. But they are good Russians, and they'll recognize that. And that Russia and Ukraine should be a kind of one nation in the future, sometime. It's kind of like the attitude of King George III to American Revolution. He believed that these are just simply, they are Englishmen, maybe of a second class, but still Englishmen. They'll recognize and they'll eventually rally around the crown. And it took almost 40 years of fighting to figure out that that's not so.
So
intermittent, of course.
So this is not about bridges across the Kerch Straits. It's not about boosting United Russia for the September elections. This is a really big undertaking, in your opinion, that the Kremlin are thinking about. And you give it 50-50 chances of actually happening.
Well, as I say, now, when you have this string of Russian moves in the last month and a half, and all leading more or less to creating Kazov's belly, well, maybe it's going to happen. Though, of course, Vladimir Putin is a cautious person. Maybe in last decision he will stand down. I don't know. And this, of course, could be good for United Russia because nothing else better unites a population than war, rallying around the flag, and they'll just simply sail to very serious election victory. You don't even have to rig it too much.
Well, it also could help Donald Trump. And there's no question over here in the United States that Russia has been interfering in this election, and specifically Putin. And it looks like Putin doesn't care if his fingerprints are on these hacks of the Democratic Party. Is he not sending a signal to the Americans that this is payback for the colored revolutions and paid back for what he thinks is Hillary Clinton's interference in 2011-2012 demonstrations against Putin?
Well, it's obvious that Trump is rather popular here in Moscow, as much as Obama and Hillary are not popular. Yes, if there's going to be in the coming several weeks big escalation in Ukraine involving Russia, Trump could say that this is a result of the failed Obama and Hillary foreign policy, and he'll maybe have a point there. Yes, and they say this is a very unique situation. It doesn't even matter who wins in November. Anyway, right now, the United States is more or less dysfunctional to a large extent. And that is a possibility that maybe Moscow will not just allow to slide.
Well, you mentioned the 2008 comparison with Georgia. The Olympics were on in Beijing. There was an American election. And, of course, as we speak, all of those conditions are happening in terms of the Rio Olympics. But also President Obama's on vacation at Martha's Vineyard. So when you say America's dysfunctional,
partially dysfunctional.
Right. You mean it's because of, I mean, aren't they trying to make some kind of modus vivendi with Russia in Syria? Although Russia's now reached out to Turkey, so maybe they're trying to change the equation. Do you think that there's any indication that the U.S. is wanting to cooperate with Russia in Syria and don't want to? I mean, in other words, If this is going to happen, if the scenario we're discussing is going to happen, surely this is time for Barack Obama to get on the phone and warn Putin that this is a bad idea.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Tell him.
Right.
But in Syria, it's not working out. Mm-hmm. Just today, Sergei Shoigu on Russian state TV said that we're failing to find any accommodation with the Americans on fighting around in Syria and around Aleppo, because kind of the John Kerry's policy was to dangle in front of the Russians proposition that we work together, but then you stop kind of really supporting the Assad people and his allies. But that doesn't work because the Russian, again, strategic intent in Syria is to help Assad win the civil war unequivocally.
Well, just in closing...
So that's, again, that is really not a rather non-functional policy. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the reason Ash Carter is very much opposed to it, believing that, anyway, strategic intentions of Russia and the United States in Syria are so far apart, there's no room for any meaningful cooperation.
Well, just in closing, returning to the possibility of a war breaking out between Russia and Ukraine... I understand from polling in Russia that the Russian people are not happy about the idea of wars. They're starting to get a little bit uncomfortable about Syria, and I imagine they would be opposed to a major war with Ukraine.
Well, Syria was never popular. Mm-hmm. To begin with, it's not popular with the population in general. It's not, that's maybe not that important since Russia is an authoritarian regime and what the people think, well, it's more or less what the state agitprop tells them to think. It's not popular with the Russian nomenclatura. Many of them believe that this was a wrong move, that there's nothing there for Russia that important to go in, and how the hell we're going to get out. Ukraine is different, and Odessa, say, speaking speculatively about Odessa, well, that's Ruskaya Zemlya, Ruski Gorod. It's unlike Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
So I would believe with the right state propaganda working full blast, this will be, at least in the beginning, a rather popular encounter. At least much more popular than anything happening in Syria.
Well, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, I thank you for joining us from Moscow. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005, he published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta, and his regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local international publications. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author David K. Johnson about his latest book, a New York Times bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who is a professor of law at Syracuse University and a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He is the author of the bestsellers Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, and the editor of the new anthology, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And his latest book, a New York Times bestseller just out, is The Making of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, nice to be here with you again.
Well, thank you, David. And just to touch on what we just heard from Moscow, the defense analyst, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, seems to think that there's a very real chance that there'll be a major war that Putin will launch to sort of break the back of Ukraine and bring them back into the fold. And he also said that it might actually end up being good for Donald Trump, who's quite popular in Moscow. And it's going to make Obama look weak and feckless, and that'll play into Trump's narrative. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, Donald Trump is popular in Moscow for the same reason Putin is. You only have state-controlled media, so people have a very unrealistic impression of both Putin, who's gone around murdering opponents and then jailing wealthy people who don't play ball with him, and of Donald Trump. I think it is important to understand that Donald Trump, who has never said a critical word of Vladimir Putin, is a supporter of one of Vladimir Putin's major, perhaps the major, foreign policy objective, which is to weaken NATO. And that should cause a lot of alarm. I mean, can you imagine if any Democratic president had ever proposed weakening NATO when it was what was sought by the leader in Moscow? The hell that would be raised over that. But amazing silence among people who claim to be principled conservatives.
And again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University and a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. His latest book, a New York Times bestseller, is just out, and that is The Making of Donald Trump. So let's talk about your book, because you wrote it almost like you were purging yourself of decades of information about Donald Trump. Am I accurately describing this huge unburdening, if you will, let me ask you this. Why have you followed this guy in the first place?
Well, when I left the Los Angeles Times in 1988 and went to Atlantic City for the Philadelphia Inquirer, I met Trump right off, and he was the dominant force in Atlantic City. And as soon as I met him, I realized he was P.T. Barnum selling you the tickets to the hoaxes like the Fiji Mermaid. What it took a couple of weeks for me to tie down was that he didn't know anything about the casino business. His competitors, some of his own people, a couple of big players, all had these stories that Donald didn't understand the games, the odds of the games, the customer management. The only thing he knew how to do was to suck money out of the businesses. And his casinos were among the most poorly managed, and that's why they were among the first to fail. But I immediately recognized he was a cultural force worth paying attention to. So in the same way that I have built up over many years files on Daryl Gates before he died, the head of the LAPD, and Baron Hilton, the hotelier, Jack Welch, and other people, to the point where one time I had to rent two storage lockers to keep all the files I had. There, a lot of them are digitized now. I just recognized that Donald was somebody who was going to keep being in the news. He was going to be very important to Atlantic City, which I had gone to cover because I thought, Ian, and turned out correctly, that casino gambling was about to take off across the country. And somebody should chronicle whether New Jersey actually cleaned up the casino business or only appeared to clean it up. And by the way, they only appeared to clean it up.
So in terms of what's happening now, do you think, and obviously because of your decades of work on taxes, I'm sure you know Ed Kleinbart. He used to be the head of the...
Oh, sure. Very well. Ed's written a great deal about his very important work.
Right. Well, Ed has a theory that the reason that Trump doesn't want to release his taxes is more to do with these businesses, that he's got an eye to the future. And, of course, Obama accused him of running for president just to improve his brand. I don't know whether that's going to be the case after this election. But the long and the short is that Ed's theory is that he's looking ahead after the election. He's more concerned about what his business competitors might learn from his tax returns. Why do you think he's holding back on releasing them?
Well, there are a couple of reasons here. And I've written a number of pieces about this, and The Making of Donald Trump has several chapters in this. First of all, We know that Donald did not pay income taxes in 1978, 1979, 1984, and in the early 90s. And in all likelihood, he has not paid income taxes in the last 40 years with maybe a couple of exceptions. That's partly because there are special rules Congress has for full-time real estate professionals. So you and I and most of the people listening have to pay our taxes, and even if we're landlords, don't qualify for these special rules that Donald does. If you qualify and you own a lot of buildings, you get to live tax-free. You basically, the government loans you your income taxes at zero interest for as long as 38 years. The second reason is there's very good evidence that Donald cheats on his taxes. And I tell in The Making of Donald Trump about two tax trials for New York State and New York City taxes. And if you're a New York resident like Donald, your federal return, your state return are virtually identical, where his own longtime tax guy said when shown the return, you know, that's my signature, but I didn't prepare that tax return. Well, who else would have prepared a tax return showing zero income from a consulting business and $600,000 of expenses? The only person who would have done it is Donald Trump. Thirdly, we know that Donald participated in a tax fraud known as the empty box scam. He bought jewelry at Bulgari, a high-end jeweler across the street from Trump Tower, and had empty boxes sent out of state. Luckily for him and Henry Kissinger and Mary Tyler Moore and a few others, he wasn't prosecuted. It was the Italian owner of the store and the store manager who were prosecuted for evading the sales tax. And then finally, this goes to Ed's point. If we had Donald's tax returns, I, Ed, a lot of other people, could reverse engineer them, and we could tell you how much his buildings are really worth, at least for tax purposes, and a whole lot of other things about his business practices. Now, understand, Donald has more than 500 business entities. Getting his tax return would mean getting a complete return, not just a Form 1040. That's the stunt that Mitt Romney pulled. He didn't give you the full returns going back many years. You need the full return, to which is all the attachments and schedules, to figure things out. But it would allow somebody to figure out what Donald's really worth. And we know that he's not worth the, depending on what day of the week it is, $8.7 billion, $10 billion, more than $10 billion, $11 billion, he said in the last year.
So in the decades of following Trump and building up this cache of research that you had to rent storage lockers for, David K. Johnson, and the new book that you've got just out, which is now a New York Times bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump. Have you been able to answer the bizarre question, or the one that certainly I find hard to follow, and that is, as you point out, the audience that's most loyal to Donald Trump can't afford to stay in Trump's hotels. Why do the people that support him, who by and large are working Americans and middle-class Americans, why do they, is it sort of like some kind of aspirational politics of winning the lottery by, you know, some of it rubbing off on you if you vote for this guy? What is this connection? Because there's no question that there's a real connection
there.
This
is one of the most Ian, this is one of the most bizarre and frustrating aspects of my life right now. As you mentioned earlier, I wrote a series of books explaining to the bottom 90% of Americans how they're being hurt by the government policies that began with the age of Reagan in 1981. These policies that take from the many and redistribute to the already super rich few. And Donald is one of the biggest welfare kings in America. He's one of the biggest beneficiaries of these little known, unless you read my books, government policies that redistribute upward. So the people I'm trying to tell about how they're being hurt, they don't tend to read my books, even though I write them so if you have a high school education, you can understand them. And Donald comes along, like all demagogues, with a simple explanation. You want to know why you're not better off, why you're working more and making less, why you don't have enough money that if you lose your job, you'll know how you'll feed your kids next week? It's the Mexicans. It's the Muslims. It's the Chinese. It's those certain areas of the country where people are stealing elections. And to a lot of people, that's an appealing argument. They don't have to think deeply about it. It resonates with their instincts, and it's simple. And by the way, Bernie Sanders was the same basic argument, except he didn't do it through racism and xenophobia. He did it through all bankers are bad, business is bad, which is better or less damaging, but still not an accurate portrayal quite of what's going on. So I'm not at all surprised that Donald has found a large minority of Americans who will support him. And then you have to add in one more factor, and that is for 40 years, the right in this country has been going after Hillary Clinton. They've never nailed her with anything significant. I mean, she said some dumb things. She's done some things that aren't smart. She's made some false statements. But, you know, the fact-checking groups basically rate her as lying at about the same rate as politicians that they follow overall, whereas Donald's off the chart. And you put those things together, and you have a guy who may be the next president of the United States. Even with what you're seeing right now, he may still be the next president of the United States.
Well, that's one of the things that worries me about these third-party runs of Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. They're gaining steam, and they could make the difference. And as we started out the program today, the possibility of a war in Ukraine that's going to make Obama look impotent and play into Trump's narrative, not to mention an attack by the Islamic State, all of these things could tip the balance, even though every day Trump seems
and
to
let me add one other factor to that, Ian.
Uh-huh.
Ian, if I can add one other factor to that. Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, he was helped in his campaign by Roger Stone. Now, Roger Stone is a Donald Trump advisor off and on throughout Donald's efforts to become president going back to 1985. He has a notorious reputation for his involvement in planting false stories and disrupting honest political conduct. And so you can't look at the Gary Young campaign from the Libertarian side without realizing that Donald has an interest in this, because if he can draw votes away from Hillary Clinton to Gary Young, it increases his chance of getting elected. The polls so far suggest that it's people who are being drawn away from Trump to Gary Young, but that wasn't the purpose. And Roger Stone is a guy whose outrageous conduct at every turn we should pay very close attention to, because his effort is always to submarine democratic process.
And, of course, you mean Gary Johnson. But one thing that Roger Stone has done...
Gary Johnson. I'm sorry, Gary Johnson.
Yeah. The one thing that Roger Stone has done is he said recently that Hillary Clinton should be put in front of a firing squad and shot. And that leads me to the question about what I consider the most dangerous aspect of the Trump campaign, and that is his biggest ally now is the National Rifle Association, and he's firing up his people talking about Second Amendment remedies and stuff like that. We have in this country more firearms, or I think for one, at least one firearm per you know, at least over 300 million firearms.
Yep.
You've got people who really yep. honestly believe that when Trump says that Hillary's going to take away their guns, they believe that. It's an absurd idea, but they believe it. And they have this anti-government fervor, like the Bundys being the model. And I don't know what numbers they are, but that is a substantial army of people. And Stone has, Roger Stone has said that if any, you know, and they keep talking about fraud and rigging the elections, and Stone has said there's going to be hell to pay if this happens. Well, that's the ingredients for some kind of massive sort of shootout in America starting on November the 9th.
Well, it only takes, you know, one person to change history. I'm not worried about the ordinary, logical, sane people and the overwhelming majority of gun owners who heard Trump say this. They recognize it's irresponsible. It's the zealots. It's the folks who listen to that kind of thing. You know, the guy who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin after Benjamin Netanyahu said basically he would destroy Israel. As soon as he was arrested, you know what he said to the authorities? I'm not crazy. I did this to save Israel. This was a knowing, deliberate political act. Mm-hmm. And it should really worry us that the Republican Party will not repudiate a man who is proposing anti-democratic means. If anybody who's watched the terrific HBO film about the 2008 election when Barack Obama won, and at the end how Sarah Palin wanted to go out and give a speech and do other stuff that's nonsense because she doesn't know anything, and Steve Schmidt explained to her and to the audience, we have a process here, and we peacefully change power, and we're not going to deviate from that process because he respects that process and respects this country. Donald Trump has no respect for this country. Donald Trump respects Donald Trump. And if you don't recognize that he, of course, should be president because he's better than the rest of us, you know, Donald has a word for you. Loser.
Yeah, but what happens if he's a loser? Can his ego take it? I mean, obviously he's preparing the way by saying it's all going to be rigging votes and fraud. But just in closing, you don't see him dropping out, do you?
Oh, no, I don't. There's no chance that Donald will drop out of this. Donald's problem is this. When he announced in 2015, and I was the only national journalist who said he might get the nomination, and he was serious this time and explained why, I said if he doesn't move to getting the nomination, his biggest problem will be how to exit and not damage his brand. Well, he has now done horrible damage to his brand. Cadillac, part of General Motors, no longer is the sponsor of the Doral Open PGA golf tournament, and they moved it to Mexico, which was a way of thumbing their nose at Trump. Trump Hotels, if you look at the prices on the internet, they're discounting more heavily than their competitors because many businesses will not have meetings there of their sales forces or technical people. You know, lots of hotel businesses running for corporate meetings where they fly everybody into town. And that business is slipped away. And so in Donald's golf courses, and some people who don't care, they'll go anyway. The New York Times has a story about that today. But there are a lot of people who go, I don't want to be associated with a Trump golf course. I don't want to be associated with that guy. He has damaged his brand. I think the story we will see if he does not win, and I still think he can win, if he doesn't win, the story we're going to see in 2017, 18, 19, 20 is going to be the damage to Donald's brand and how he's going to try to prop it up. Because Donald has a lot of cash flow, and he's unquestionably a wealthy man, but he's not worth $8, $10, $11 billion. I mean, I don't think it's possible he's worth more than a billion, and he's probably worth less than that.
Well, David K. Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us. And again, your book, The Making of Donald Trump, is must reading in this turbulent election year.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Ian. I appreciate that. And luckily, all around the world, people want to read this book. We've sold it in every English-language country in the world in a German-language edition that tells you a lot about how people outside of America are looking at our politics and going, what the?
Okay. On that note, I thank David K. Johnson, a professor of law at Syracuse University, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, that he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. His latest book, a New York Times bestseller just out, is The Making of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's the director of the Franklin & Marshall poll, about Donald Trump's call in Pennsylvania to help me stop Crooked Hillary from rigging this election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He has written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which is renamed the Franklin and Marshall College Poll. And he's the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Terry Madonna.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And Terry, what did you make of this rally on Friday in Pennsylvania where Donald Trump used clear racial overtones in front of a mostly white audience, where he claimed that the only way he will lose in this key swing state is if, in quotes, in certain areas, other people don't come and in and vote five times?
Right. Oh, I don't think there's, look, no one can argue that there isn't voter fraud. I mean, that it currently exists and has existed. The place that gets most of the attention is in the city of Philadelphia, where over the past decade, some election officials have been prosecuted for violations of the of election law, usually involving multiple voting, a couple of votes here and there. But in fact, now I'm not defending that, but none of them, and that nothing that I have seen in any of the reporting that has been done, suggested that it could overturn the election results, meaning extensive enough to overcome an election. The root cause of the current situation comes when in 2012 in Philadelphia, in 59 what they call divisions, that's places where people would go to vote, there are almost 1,700 of them in the city of Philadelphia, not a single vote was cast for Mitt Romney. Hear what I just said, 59 divisions, not one vote. Now, when you get into it, and this has been looked at by PolitiFact and others, when you get into it, these 59 divisions cover about a 7 or 8 block area in heavily African-American districts. So statistically, it's possible that, in fact, in places like that where they have 12, 15 registered Republicans in a division, that, you know, this was exactly what happened. And so I think that's where the argument that Trump was using basically stems from, because that made the news. It was a pretty big story for a while. And as I said, just recently, three election officials voted, you know, were charged with a crime. What was the crime? That they voted in place of a relative, or for someone else. You get the point. But again, it's not going to overturn an election, meaning it's not going to change the outcome. I'm not defending it. It's wrong, and it needs to stop.
But with Hillary Clinton over 9 points ahead, it's a pretty extraneous argument, isn't it? We're only talking about a handful of votes that could possibly be fraudulent.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that. I mean, 9 points, we're talking about a victory that is going to be, you know, and again, I'm not predicting that. I mean, you know, this election has more twists and turns than your average boa constrictor, you know, going up a tree, and who knows what's likely to happen before it's over. But it's not going to change the outcome of a 9-point victory or a 5-point victory, any substantial victory. And there are watchdog groups in the city that constantly monitor this. And again, I'm not going to suggest it doesn't take place. I'm not that naive. I know the city of Philadelphia. I polled in it, for example, and in mayoral elections, you know, for mayors in the city in the past. But the fact is that it's just not going to change the outcome of who wins Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. And he's the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. But surely you have to balance what we're talking about with this sort of minuscule voter fraud compared to the blatant efforts by the Republican governor and the Republican legislature in Pennsylvania to basically scrub the poll, scrub the voting rolls, and do pretty blatant voter suppression.
Yeah, I mean, the voter ID law, by the way, was chucked out by
sure.
court, so that's it's gone. I must tell you that it was fairly popular. I polled on it, and so did other pollsters. It was popular with the voters on the argument that you have to provide a driver's license to do just about anything, get admitted to a, you know, to see a physician, to get on an airplane, to do just about everything. But that issue was hugely, hugely controversial. You're exactly right. And the courts threw it out, mainly because there wasn't a lot of evidence that without it, there was that much fraud, as we just been talking about. So it was a law that, and by the way, after it was chucked out by the court, the state didn't appeal it. Did you hear just what I said?
Yeah.
It wasn't appealed.
Right.
It went nowhere. So, you know, they could have appealed it to a higher court, and they didn't bother to do it. So my sense is that that issue is gone. We now have a Democratic governor. He would veto any efforts by a Republican-controlled legislature, and there's been no effort in the state legislature in Pennsylvania to redo it, you know, to re-up it. It's not going to happen.
So what explains then this, you know, I think Obama won the state by, what, 4 or 5 points?
Five points, exactly.
Yeah, Hillary's ahead by 9. What happened to Trump in this state? The very state that Obama made that off-the-cuff remark about when he said people cling to their guns and their Bibles.
Right. That's a great question. And in short, as you know, after the Trump convention, the national, in the Real Clear Politics average, Trump actually had a 1-point lead. Huffington Post had him down 1. So let's call that an even election. In my state, Pennsylvania, one of the swing states, Trump trailed Clinton by 2.5 points. So what happened to change all of that? What happened nationally is also what affected the polls in my state. What happened nationally was Trump, well, he got about a 3-point bounce. The 538 blog said this bounce was about 3 points. Some said it was 4. Okay. So he goes to this situation where he's 1 point up in the Real Clear Politics average. So then what happens? He gets involved in this business with Putin and Russia and the State Department and emails, and if they have them, should they turn them over? The suggestion was made that he said, and I don't know that he said that, but that's what the argument was, that he wanted the Russians to hack into the statement part and emails. But worse, over the weekend after his convention, or actually while Secretary Clinton's convention had just ended, he gets involved in this controversy with the Muslim family, the Khan family, whose son, Captain Khan, a Muslim, lost his life in Iraq. And that creates a downward spiral in the polls. So you have a much better Clinton convention, and this isn't Terry Madonna saying it, it's the voters. She gets a 6 or 7 point bounce. He gets the negatives from the situation with Captain Khan. And then this week he continues, and last week, to get involved in controversies over the Second Amendment and whether or not the president is the founder of ISIS. So what happens nationally? He's now down 7 points nationally, 7 points. And in my state, he's down 9. So you begin to see the transformation. So in a sense, Pennsylvania's votes have always been kind of a couple points more Democratic than the nation as a whole. So you can see that playing out in Pennsylvania. And look at the other battleground states where Trump was doing reasonably well, under 5 points in most of them. Now he trails in every single battleground point state, rather, and he's losing Georgia, of all things.
So when the previous guest, David K. Johnson, has just got a new book about Trump out, what do you make of his contention that, you know, that Trump still could win?
Yeah. Oh, look, we've seen it twice in the last 4 months. Donald Trump has caught Secretary Clinton, caught her in the polls. I think the one word that I use when I'm talking with groups about this presidential election is unpredictable. I think we just don't know what's likely to happen in the remaining months of the campaign. We don't know what the emails will eventually turn up with the business with the Clinton Foundation. They don't seem to be having a big effect now. I mean, this election is so unpredictable, and I've been, as a professor teaching the American presidency for 25, 30 years, I've never seen anything like this, and it's in a sense weird. And I don't think we can know for sure. I agree with him. I don't think we can say for sure that Trump can't win. Right now, if you look, you'd say probably not. The odds aren't with him. He's down by a huge percentage nationally. And remember, it's the battleground states that matter. I don't want to insult the listeners of your great station out there, but we know how California is going to vote. You know what I mean?
Right.
We know how New York's going to vote. And similarly, we can go through the states that the Republicans are going to win. Although we are seeing a couple of states like Georgia in play, and who would have thunk that, as they say. And, you know, there's some other states that are in play that we haven't seen before, at least not in the last six elections. And so it's hard to know for sure, given what we don't know. We have a debate. We have three debates coming up. Debates typically only one in American history. In presidential history has really affected the outcome. But this year, almost anything could happen.
Well, just in the last minute then, Dr. Terry Madonna, the one thing that I find concerning, and so do others, that is this appeal to the Second Amendment people that Donald Trump has made. There are so many arms in this country. There's a lot of people like the Bundys out there who honestly believe that the government is a form of tyranny and that real patriots have to step up. Roger Stone, Trump's advisor, has said, and they're laying the groundwork, talking about fraud and rigging the votes, they're laying the groundwork for a backlash if Trump loses. Does that worry you?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, look, if Donald Trump loses, I think the argument can be made that he lost this election by his intemperate remarks, by the nature of his campaign. And I thought most of us, again, these so-called experts that thought Trump was done during the course of the primary, you know, the comments about John McCain, the comments about Carly Fiorina, we can go on for an hour talking about them. But he hasn't shifted the focus of the campaign from the primary to the general. Now, he had a very respectable, again, now we don't have to agree with him, economic platform. And so what happens 2 days later, he steps on the message, right? Because that's the nature of who he is. Who knows what's going to happen, whether it turns into a third party, whether these his supporters end up just dropping out of the system. We could be in for another realignment of voters that occurs every several generations, or not producing a new solid majority for one party. We'll have to see.
Well, Dr. Terry Madonna, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at the Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He's written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which was renamed the Franklin and Marshall College poll. And he's the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.